This is episode 41 for July 10th, and we're going to get started this week talking about something I've been just dying to talk about since we've started, and that is the Coen brothers, because we've never, ever mentioned Joel and Ethan Coen in this podcast before, except for every previous episode. I will be doing a director spotlight on them. Sam will have a trivia question, and kind of sticking with the Coen brothers theme, we'll be doing a top six list on film noir. Of course, the Coens are great at that. And then we'll close out with the last installment of our ratings and censorship industry trend, taking a look at the history of ratings and censorship in the modern era. I'm Stephen Keller.
And I'm Sam Stoddard, and pretend I told a joke, Stephen, about this week's episode. And it's pretty funny.
Oh, you're a wacky guy, Sam. Good times.
Actually, I do have a joke, because our trivia question is going to be about not wearing makeup.
Uh-huh.
And as it turns out, I am not wearing makeup for this podcast.
Huh.
So I don't know if that is that a good thing or not. Do you wear makeup for the podcasts?
Of course. I'm not a slacker the way you are.
Oh,
I bring it
sorry.
Every day. Also, I'm dressed as a woman. The films of the Coen brothers have been a real staple of our discussions here on All Movie Talk. If you haven't noticed, Sam and I are both big fans of them. Just for me personally, really getting into their movies and watching their films, that was really one of the things that made me into really more of a movie fan. They're one of the first directors that I really came to just absolutely adore their filmography. And I think that's for a lot of reasons that we keep talking about them, in part because their movies are so varied. I mean, they have a real diverse style to them, and they've made a lot of movies that have just particularly memorable bits to them that they're really worth talking about. So we're going to do a two-part director spotlight on them. Technically, Joel Coen is the director and Ethan Coen is the producer, but in reality, they kind of collaborated on the movie, so most people would say that together the two of them are the authors of their film. So it's not like, okay, it's Joel who's the main guy. They're really both kind of part and parcel. That's why we call them the Coen brothers. And so, I mean, why do we care about the Coen brothers? In part, it's because they're influential. Since the early 80s, they've been a pretty big force, especially in the 1990s. You know, they're one of the, I think, premier American filmmakers. They've influenced lots of other people. And also because their movies are very entertaining. They're always interesting and funny when they're funny, or some of the more serious stuff is just really wonderful drama. I mean, they've made never any real huge smash box office hits, but they've made a lot of movies that have been very successful, either commercially or critically, or both sometimes, such as Fargo, which did well at the box office, was nominated for Best Picture, and is a really well-respected movie. And, you know, they've also done stuff like The Big Lebowski and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou that have become real cult favorites. Certainly lots of people love those movies today. And so these two guys are two of those guys who sort of grew up making Super 8 movies. And Super 8 was the camcorder before the camcorder existed, basically. Really low-quality film that you could get kind of cheaply back in the day. And so they used to go make Super 8 movies when they were kids and teenagers. Joel Coen, I guess, saved up money mowing lawns so he could buy a Super 8 camera, and they started making their own productions. And Joel went through the NYU film program, while Ethan has a degree in philosophy from Princeton. So, I mean, clearly these are pretty smart guys, both prestigious schools. NYU, if you don't know, is one of the top film schools in the nation. And, you know, it was there that Joel kind of produced a student film, and then they kind of, after college, reunited to start working on movies again. Joel worked as an assistant editor on the first Evil Dead movie, where he met Sam Raimi, and they worked together, and not long after that, the two Coen brothers were able to find some people to pony up the cash to get their first film, Blood Simple, made, and that was released in 1984. And that was a hit, and it led to them being able to go ahead and sort of work around the periphery, making independent movies. Though really, sort of with Fargo, and since the mid-90s, they've really become more mainstream. You know, now they work with bigger stars, that kind of thing, before they work, you know, sort of smaller actors or still unknown actors, and these days they make movies that are pretty big studio productions. But again, we're not really talking about, you know, these guys aren't Michael Bay. They're not making $100 million movies where they make $300 million at the box office. So this week we're going to talk a bit about their styles, and we're going to do like what we've done in the past with director spotlights, and next week we'll talk about their movies themselves. So I think the most, I don't know, if you had to pick stylistically, what would you think is the predominant thing about the Coen, Sam?
Oh gosh, there's a lot. One of the more interesting stylistic things is, to me, how they tap into the classic films, you know, the classic genres. They take a screwball comedy, they'll take a gangster movie or something like that, something that might have come from the 30s or 40s that seemed to be particularly interested in those time periods, and then sort of just skew it, give it a modern sensibility, give it a sense of humor, a real sardonic kind of humor to it, and then just make a movie in that style that has their own personality in it. I really like how they do that with screwball comedy and the Hudsucker Proxy or gangster movies and Miller's Crossing, or, you know, they'll do things like that, and that's really interesting to me, or noir in Fargo.
Oh, absolutely. That was the number one thing I had for their style as well. It's their classic, their sense of classic Hollywood. And it goes a little bit beyond just Hollywood.
And a lot of directors today don't have that sense either. A lot of new directors, they're excited about making movies, and they don't have that sense of history. And, you know, so they're either repeating what other people have done or just not doing it as well or whatever, and you really get a connection with the past with these. And yet you can come into them and not know all that stuff and still enjoy them. That's neat.
Yeah, that's what I like too. Like I said, when I started watching Coen Brothers movies, I didn't know that much about film history, and I still really connected with them. You know, I loved Fargo. That was the movie that got me into the Coens. I just loved Fargo so much, and then I really enjoyed The Big Lebowski when it came out 2 years later. So, but yeah, I mean, I didn't when I first saw The Big Lebowski, I had no idea who Raymond Chandler was or what The Big Sleep was, and yet it still worked for me. And now, you know, that I'm a big Chandler fan and love The Big Sleep, I watch The Big Lebowski and get, oh, it's okay, so it's a parody, it's hilarious, it's even funnier. And yeah, I mean, they definitely, like you said, they take from classic films and they make it their own. I mean, and you actually picked exactly the same three genres I had written down.
Oh, noir, that's funny.
Screwball, and gangster. I mean, those are really their big three. Noir shows up in almost all of their films in some way or another. There are noir elements in, maybe not The Hudsucker Proxy, maybe not Intolerable Cruelty, but for the most part, they, I mean, it just squirms their way in. When they're not directly making, I mean, The Man Who Wasn't There is a direct noir film. It made to look like a film from the 40s or the 50s. You know, Fargo has a definite noir feel to it. But then, you know, movies like Blood Simple and even the gangster movie Miller's Crossing both have real noirish feels to them. Miller's Crossing is like a gangster movie had it been made a little bit later in time, I think.
And then the connection to early Hollywood is very apparent in Barton Fink,
right,
which is about making a movie in early Hollywood. And so
right,
even their version of the 1930s looks more like a movie version of the 1930s, where you got the big, and this is a trademark of them, this shows up in a lot of different places. You got a big authority figure, a fat guy behind a desk with a cigar and chewing you out. And that shows up in Barton Fink. It shows up in Blood Simple. That's in a number of movies. For whatever reason, they like that image. But that is very much something out of the 30s, a 30s type of authority figure, a head of a corporation or a media mogul or some, or a politician. Somebody like that was very much more respected and feared in the 1930s than we do today, where we just say, oh yeah, they're just scamming money, they're rich, you know, spoiled brats and everything. We don't have any respect for that power. And in the 1930s, they definitely did. And in his these movies, there seems to be always that figure that feels very much like it came out of the 30s.
Yeah, and they like to get, you know, the Venetian blind streaming light into the guy's face or something crazy.
Sure.
Like that. Yeah, they love that. Yeah. They're obsessed with that. And I think that goes with, generally, a Coen Brothers film is highly stylized. The style kind of differs from movie to movie, but it's always, you know, you're not going to get a real natural kind of feeling movie. I think maybe their first film, Blood Simple, has got kind of a natural low-key feel to it. But really from then on, once I had some money to start playing around with, they are going to get just more and more stylized. I mean, everything from the scripts, you know, the way they write their dialogue, to the camera work, to the way the movies look, to the way they even sound, everything is very, very stylized. You mentioned they like, okay, the big guy behind the desk. Well, they like big everything if they can get it. I mean, they're going to like, they like to skew sizes. I mean, we mentioned other genres. We didn't really mention expressionism, which also plays, I think, a part in Coen Brothers' films, maybe just by way of the noir influence. But, yeah, I mean, anytime they can make something ridiculously disproportionate with what it would be in real life, they're going to like to do it. And they really just delight in being weird. Sometimes I think they like to just be weird for weirdness' sake, which, you know, it works particularly well in a comedy. Raising Arizona is a great comedy. And I think a lot of people, you know, you talk to a lot of people, and there are people who get it, and there are people who don't. And the people who don't get it, I don't know, they tend to kind of criticize it, I think, for being weird. But that's the whole point, is of course it's bizarre. I don't know. I mean, and then a lot of times they also, I think, deliberately be strange to bring points home. It's sort of that expressionistic thing where you exaggerate something to make a point.
Yeah.
But they do that a lot.
Yeah, and Raising Arizona is a good example, though, because it's beyond just skewing something. It's even creating whole characters that don't... I don't know what the guy on the motorcycle is about. I still don't. It's sort of funny, but... what is that about? That's just really strange. But yet, they can also rein it in, too, if it's called for, you know, in something like... well, in Fargo, I mean, that's a pretty tight story. There's some weirdness in it, but it doesn't feel unrealistic. It feels like a pretty solid story behind there.
That's true. And
so they can rein it in if they need to. But yeah, you also mentioned camera work. They love big camera moves. And I became a fan, I think, of Barry Sonnenfeld as a director before I discovered the Coens. And it turns out, you know, Sonnenfeld was the cinematographer on their early films. And, you know, Raising Arizona, there's these big shots that are fast tracking shots going up a ladder and into a room and all kinds of stuff like that. They love that stuff. Hudsucker Proxy has something where a guy's fallen off a skyscraper. There's some great photography there shooting that. And, oh, gosh, it's really inventive kinetic camera moves that just look cool and but also convey the point. This is exaggerated, but here's the emotion behind it. Have all of it in a way that you maybe haven't seen before. Virtuoso filmmaking, I think, is the term.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about their cinematography, because it's such an important point in their movies. In fact, they've only had two cinematographers. You mentioned, of course, their first one, Barry Sonnenfeld, who lensed Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, and Miller's Crossing. But since then, since Barton Fink, it's all been Roger Deakins. And, of course, you know Sonnenfeld probably as a director, like you said. He directed the Addams Family movies, the Men in Black movies, Wild Wild West.
He lost it somewhere.
Yeah, at some point in time, Sonnenfeld stopped making good movies, but certainly his camera work in those three films that he did for the Coens really set the tone that Deakins would build on, I think, and that is a very strange, like everything else, a very strange and kind of surreal look. He used a lot of wide lenses that distorted the way things were, especially the sizes. We mentioned they like to play around with size. That's definitely Sonnenfeld. And a very harsh kind of look to it. Both Raising Arizona and Miller's Crossing, and to a lesser extent Blood Simple, are very harsh. Raising Arizona is kind of blown out. It's got that sort of really harsh white and orange look. It takes place in the desert. Everything's a little overexposed. Miller's Crossing is the exact opposite. It looks almost like a black and white film, very, very dark, and lots of dark grays and greens and rain-slicked streets as it takes place in the 1930s among all these gangsters, that kind of thing. And they like lots of strong contrasts, especially, again, we mentioned those dark movies, the film noir kind of stuff. But Deakins, I think, takes them in a little bit more lush direction. Certainly they've made lush films since Deakins. Fargo is lush in its own way, all that brilliant white snow fields that are also kind of harsh. But movies like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Or Intolerable Cruelty have a real kind of really lush old Hollywood, old Technicolor kind of look to them. They use computers to post-process all of the color in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? That was one of the first films to make use of that technique, where I think pretty much every frame of film was color-corrected digitally, and you know, you get those colors that you could never capture easily on film. And so that's kind of the way they always look. Again, the colors, the camera movements, like you mentioned, they love those big, long, huge, crazy tracking shots or traveling shots. I mean, cranes, everything that they can do to drive home a point. I mean, they're going to always be using the camera work to play up the point that their movies are making.
And the other thing I like about Deakins, and not just in their movies for the Coens, but just in general, he's good, number one, at color, as you say, but also frame composition. There's just his frames are beautiful. Pause a movie that he has shot, and it looks nice. It's nice, balanced imagery and everything. And, I mean, if it's appropriate for the movie, and usually is. And that just gives you a sense that you're watching something that's interesting. I think sometimes we talk about, well, the cinematography or the editing or whatever, and people who are not excited about those things in particular kind of turn you off. You know, I don't care about the editing, I just want to watch a good movie. Well, this is how you make a good movie. This is why something looks compelling to you, is because the cinematography is well thought out, and Deakins is just brilliant. He's one of the best cinematographers working today at coming up with these colors and compositions that are attractive and that drive home some sort of emotional point that complements the story, and that's definitely visible in all his movies for the Coen.
Absolutely. I love Deakins.
Especially The Man Who Wasn't There, which is shot in black and white. It just looks so stark and evocative and beautiful.
I agree.
Absolutely gorgeous movie.
Some other things that are indicative of the Coen style. they have a real specific method of acting they like to get from their actors. I mentioned that I don't think they're getting very naturalistic. I think they're kind of getting away from that. But their dialogue tends to be the dialogue and the way they have their actors deliver it tends to be a strange hybrid between natural and stylized, depending on the movie. I think when they really got to the Hudsucker Proxy, that's a definite, deliberate attempt to recreate the sound and feel of 30s and 40s screwball comedies. And generally, the acting is not overly naturalistic. Sometimes it is. I think, again, you can mention Fargo as being one in which maybe Frances McDormand's performance kind of embodies what I'm talking about. Her performance seems natural, but in a sense, it's not. It walks a fine line between being a little more real than real, if you get my meaning. You know, that Midwestern accent she has that sounds believable. I mean, people do talk like that, but at the same time, it's very distinct and very obvious. Do you get what I'm saying at all, Sam? Does this make any sense? Am I just...
Yeah, it's hyper-real.
Yeah, kind of.
I don't know what that term actually means, but it means what I want it to mean in my case. It's so real that it just could not possibly be real.
Right. And sometimes, though, they just do go for pure style. The narration.
Yeah, I think more often they're stylized.
But even in a flick like, I think The Big Lebowski has some tremendously weird dialogue, and it's given in a very naturalistic sense. It's just so strange, you can't imagine it being natural. I mean,
yeah.
John Goodman's just screaming and pulling a gun on the guy when he steps over the line in a bowling game. It somehow feels natural, despite the fact that it's clearly not. That's kind of thing that only happened in a movie. And another interesting thing about the Coens is their loyalty. We mentioned they've only used two cinematographers. Well, they've only ever had one guy, Carter Burwell, score their films. They brought in some other help for Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, but Burwell still supervised all of that. I mean, he scored every one of their movies, and they work constantly with the same actors. John Goodman, Steve Buscemi, Frances McDormand, who was actually married to Joel Coen. Part of the reason, you know, she's very first in Blood Simple is one of the movies that got her start. And of course, that tour de force Oscar-winning performance from Fargo. They worked with George Clooney, John Polito, lots and lots of guys they work with over and over and over again. In a sense, it goes back to their old Hollywood kind of roots, where you got a lot of times directors and actors working together over and over because they were in the same studio, and that was part of the studio system. So I think that's an interesting thing to do. I mean, certainly when you watch a Coen Brothers movie, you're just hoping that John Goodman will show up at some point. And they get things out of their actors that nobody else does. I don't think John Goodman... I just don't understand. It's like you watch a Coen Brothers movie with John Goodman and you think, wow, this guy is such a brilliant actor. This guy is just the funniest guy on the planet. And then you go and watch any other movie with John Goodman in it and it's like, what? Is this the same guy? I mean, how is that? How did they get such wonderful performances out of him in particular, but out of really everybody? I mean, certainly.
And you know what's interesting is that there's two different kind of ways to direct actors. One is, you know, do your thing. And the other is, I want you to look this way and turn your head this way and say this inflection and everything. And most actors will not put up with that latter style. But that is the Coen style. They'll say, I want you to do this exactly like this. I want you to move your hand like this, whatever. And basically, it's them acting, not to discredit the actors too much, because they have to be able to deliver those coordinated movements and everything convincingly. But they exercise a lot of control. And it's interesting, you talk about the actors who come out. It doesn't matter which brother it is. You can ask either one a question, you'll get the same answer.
Yeah.
So it's kind of neat. I don't know how they get that kind of synchronicity, but...
Well, I mean, they've just worked so long together. And they also write everything together. They have pretty much sole screenwriting credit. A couple of them, you know, sometimes they'll do movies that are based on things. Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is allegedly based on the Odyssey, but not really. I mean, it just takes kind of some of the general ideas. I think maybe the one exception, okay, The Lady Killers was a straight remake of an earlier film, and Intolerable Cruelty, I think somebody else wrote the original script, and they came in and changed it around, which is probably part of the reason it's not a very good movie. But their scripts are really wonderful. Very, very sharp dialogue, whether it's serious satire or something else entirely. They're wonderfully sharp dialogue. I think so many quotable lines from their films.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, virtually every bit of dialogue. I have a good friend of mine who really, really loves movies, and his favorite Coen Brothers movie is Miller's Crossing, which I always think is a weird choice, but he describes the dialogue there as being like Shakespeare, which I think it is. If you just watch Miller's Crossing and just listen to the dialogue, or just even better, you can just read it, just turn on the subtitles and really watch it, I think it actually does improve the film.
Hmm.
They also love twists. You know, they write some very surprising scripts that go into some interesting places. They're not afraid to shy away from things that they bring up. I'm thinking especially of Fargo, which doesn't at all shy away from some bad consequences when things go bad. They really go bad, and the Coens are really good at doing that. Once people are committed to something, they're just following through in it. And that works as well in comedy. I think, you know, one of the kind of central concepts of screwball comedy is to really follow a situation to its logical conclusion, no matter how insane that conclusion may seem. As long as, you know, the steps you take to get there all make sense, then it works. And they also not afraid of violence. They're rarely overly graphic. You know, they're not going to show you a ton of gore, but, you know, they will show you blood, and they will have violence be central to the movie. They're not going to be afraid of it. Miller's Crossing is a violent movie. Barton Fink has some surprising violent moments. You don't see it coming at all, and there it is. And, you know, it's often used to punctuate scenes. It's never gratuitous. That's one thing I really appreciate about the Coens, is that when they have violence, it carries weight. Sometimes it can be comedic, in a sense. You know, there's that scene with the body that won't die in Blood Simple. That's darkly funny, and, you know, there's some funny violence in The Big Lebowski as well, some of that kind of stuff. Almost Tarantino-esque in a way, though. You know, they predate Tarantino, but it still, you know, it's like Tarantino, but completely different, if that helps you out at all.
Well, I was going to say, actually, that I think the art of dialogue writing is kind of suffering now. We have so many movies with inane lines that are just purely plot-serving, you know, run away from this thing
right
before it'll blow up. I mean, you got all that stuff. But there are three people, I think, counting the Coens as one person, that have dialogue that you can recognize anywhere just by hearing it. And that would be the Coen brothers, also Tarantino and David Mamet.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know their dialogue just by hearing it, and that's really neat. I could listen to anything that they write without even knowing what the story is or watching the movie. Just hearing the dialogue is something that has its own appeal.
Yeah, so, you know, you could read a Coen script, I think, and be almost as good as watching the movie. Well, speaking of their movies, next week we will be covering their films in more detail, so check back then.
Well, this week's trivia question is going to be another one about vampires, and I don't know, they're interesting, there's a lot of them. The trivia question this week is going to be to name all of the actors that have ever played a vampire in the movies. Do you think you can get this one, Steven?
Yeah, that'll be no problem at all.
All right, no, I'm kidding. The real question is, which actor who played a vampire was found so ugly by the director that in real life now that he figured that, you know, the only makeup would be needed would be just some ears and false teeth, and he would pass for a perfect vampire because he was just so ridiculously ugly. Think about who might have played vampires in history, and maybe you can come up with the answer. We'll get back to it at the end of the show. Time for our top six list this week, and we're going to talk about our top six favorite films noir. And it's going to be a little bit hybrid, kind of disconnected, because I think, Steven, you wound up picking some neo-noirs, right?
And I did.
And I stuck to the classics, so keep that in mind. But if you want to know more about film noir, we talk about it in depth in episode 20 and neo-noir in 21, so you can go back there. So we're just going to kind of do a recall of that segment and cover some of our favorites. These aren't necessarily the best. I think it's pretty much impossible to pick the best films of this genre, but there's so many that are pretty much all equally good, but some of our favorites. Okay, well, my number six is probably the most famous role of Joan Crawford's, and the movie and the character is called Mildred Pierce, and it's from 1945, pretty much the heyday of noir, a little bit on the early side, but definitely the genre's in full swing at that time. It's kind of hard to describe because a lot of these movies are heavily involved in crime, gangsters, murder mysteries, that sort of thing. This one's a little bit more toward real life. You get into situations where you have pretty much ordinary people involved in situations that cause them to be distressed or obsessed or whatever. Some kind of tragedy drives them to great extremes. And that's quite a bit different from the other sort of the other half of noir where you have these crazy people doing crazy things. You know, it almost feels like a biopic, actually, Mildred Pierce. So it's aptly titled after the character. We follow her life through a bunch of different situations. I guess it's hard to describe now that I'm trying to why I like it so much, but it just feels like a very authentic character put through some interesting but very realistic situations. A lot of room for psychological exploration of character here.
Yeah, and like you mentioned with my list, I went for more diversity. My initial list was like 15 movies, so I decided, yeah, I didn't want to just pick a bunch of great crime movies from the 40s and 50s, so I'm going to kind of deliberately, you know, pick some of those and also just pick around and other movies. So I'm going to start off with a neo-noir that I really like, and it's the film Body Heat from 1981 by Lawrence Kasdan. It's a great noir that owes a debt of gratitude to Double Indemnity, which I have a feeling we'll be talking about a little bit later in this list. It stars William Hurt and Kathleen Turner, and it's a movie about love and lust and murder with a lot of interesting, surprising twists. Kind of cool. We don't necessarily think of noir as having necessarily a ton of twists. A lot of the great noir stories are actually fairly simple, and they kind of just go in ways that we expect them to, given what we know about the characters. What Body Heat is all about, that kind of point where lust can just drive you so crazy into murder, and Turner is just fantastic as a femme fatale, and it's just a lot of fun. One of the, I think, the better examples of neo-noir that really tries to pay homage to the great old noir.
Yeah, definitely. This one feels like the most authentic you can get. This is the neo-noir that really feels like a film noir, and not just using the style, but really using the heart of the film noir idea. My number five, it is a murder mystery, and it's called Laura from 1944. Great movie by Otto Preminger, and how do I describe it? I think it's inspired a lot by Alfred Hitchcock's Rebecca. I kind of think of both movies at the same time when I think of, you know, one or the other, where we have a woman who is dominating the story, but she's not even on the scene. We're trying to solve this mystery of this dead girl, Laura. But you know how there's that cliche in Agatha Christie-type mysteries where somebody gets killed and everybody hated the person, and so you got to find out which one actually killed it because everybody's got a motive. Well, in this one, nobody has a motive, pretty much. I mean, every man that met her fell in love with her. It's that sort of situation. And so the investigator to the crime is going through trying to solve this mystery, and it's like he's trying to solve the mystery of the death of a real icon. I mean, everybody loved her, everybody looked up to her, well, except maybe somebody who probably had a motive to kill her, because she was indeed killed. So how do we resolve this situation? But yeah, it's a very tangible presence, this Laura character, even though she doesn't really take up any screen time to speak of. So I just really like how this goes down and how it explores a lot of facets of different people's obsessions with this one character.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned Hitchcock and Rebecca. Well, for my number five pick, I'm actually going to pick another Hitchcock movie that's not quite noir. Again, like I said, I tried to stick away from some of these safer classics and give a little more variety, so I'm glad that you picked some of the real sort of hard and fast standards of the movement. Because my number five is Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt from 43. Not really a true noir. It's interesting because it's Rebecca has some noirish elements, but it's kind of another movement style all of its own, that older, like, gothic kind of style. But Shadow of a Doubt takes the kind of noir elements and brings them to a small town, which a young girl is visited by her uncle, who is this killer, played by Joseph Cotten, and she's the only one who suspects him, perhaps, of being evil. And it's just really wonderful the way that Hitchcock plays around with a lot of the moods and styles of noir, especially a lot of the lighting. He uses a lot of just wonderful, wonderful lighting tricks. If you study any kind of cinematography or film criticism, this is a movie that gets mentioned a lot in terms of developing the noir style, and just in wonderful, wonderful ways that Hitchcock uses black and white to constantly, I mean, there's constantly all these frames where you'll have the girl on one side of the frame and Joseph Cotten on the other, and one side will be light and the other side will be dark, and it's just crazy because obviously it's just, you know, really trying to illustrate the idea that he is evil, and that he, you know, he's almost in a way so evil that it makes everything around him darker. It's really great, really creepy, one of Hitchcock's best, which says a lot, and just a wonderful film that, if not quite true noir, definitely is really, really noir-like.
Yeah, it is. I think that was his personal favorite of all his movies, and I definitely wouldn't go that far. But great movie, and certainly great performances in it. Well, I picked Hitchcock as well for number four, but it is a different one. It's Notorious from 1946, kind of a wartime espionage noir. And again, like a lot of noir seems to take people, put them into situations like, you know, a crime gangster kind of thing, a murder mystery sort of thing, or here, a wartime spying scenario, and see what it does to people's relationships and their emotions and their passions and everything. Well, this one does that, definitely. Basically, this girl is hired to be a spy and to pretend to be in love with somebody to gain information. And of course, you know, there's certainly more moral questions here than I think we'd have today. So there's all those situations going on as well. You know, how far do you go to mess with somebody's head for the cause of the war? This movie really explores that question, but without really asking the question, it just explores the issues at stake as it investigates the relationships between three different characters. Cary Grant, Ingrid Bergman, and Claude Rains are the actors here. The movie just does a lot of really intriguing things with that, those relationships, and ends. The ending is just brilliant, a stroke of genius. I mean, most of these movies sort of end with some kind of big action climax, and this one is very subdued and all the more powerful for it.
No doubt, a great film, but do you think it's a noir? Obviously, you do, but I think that's a little questionable.
Yeah, no, I kind of think so. I mean, it's definitely skating on the edge, and I think it has a lot more to do with the noir style rather than what I was saying earlier about really getting to the heart of noir, which is, would be Laura and body heat and everything. But
it is a great movie, though. I can understand why you'd
It's a good example of the influence, at least.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to take another sort of neo-noir-ish film for number four, and it's the 1998 film Dark City by director Alex Proyas. It's, I think we probably talked about it before, maybe way back early on in the show, but it's a movie that kind of takes the real essence of noir and throws them on the screen and does some interesting things with it. In other words, it's deliberately about taking characters from various, well, we're not really sure where they come from, and putting them into this manufactured city that looks like it came from the films of the 30s and 40s and 50s, and it's just wonderfully dark. For the fact it's called Dark City, makes a point of never being light, and though it's not in black and white, you get the feeling that maybe it could be, and that it would still work okay, and I just love the way that it subtly plays with noir conventions, and it just proves how versatile noir can be. It's you know, you can take noir and put it in a science fiction kind of setting, and it works really, really well. And I think also, like most great noir films, Dark City is ultimately about its characters and the decisions they make, and about the struggle between characters and their environment, and whether or not they can overcome the situations in which they are put.
I think it could definitely work in black and white, but I don't know. I think there's a great use of color here, even though there's not a lot of color. I think of blue, and I think of the movie at all, for some reason, a very dark blue is what I think of visually.
Really?
It's almost like it uses colors to subvert them and say, hey, here are these colors that are supposed to be bright and everything, but it's not. And so that kind of adds to the creepiness a little bit, maybe. I don't know. I'm just kind of talking off the top of my head here, but definitely a great movie, very atmospheric and brilliant visually, and even thematically. All right, number three for me, another one that kind of skates on the edge of the genre. We've talked about it before. It's The Maltese Falcon, which is sort of a proto-noir. Humphrey Bogart really turned his career around with this by playing this character of Sam Spade, and he's immersed in this glamorously weird, dangerous world. For one thing, you've got Peter Lorre, and absolutely nobody is better than him at portraying this, you know, diminutive, slithery kind of menace. And for another thing, you got Sidney Greenstreet as the intellectual villain, this fat, cigar-smoking crime boss. I've heard it somewhere that Greenstreet was the inspiration behind Jabba the Hutt. No idea if that actually is true, but certainly plausible. Now, you know, as I said, when we talked about film noir, we made the point that it isn't quite a noir film. It's got some values that aren't quite as dark as the noir genre would later develop. But I love this movie so much, I had to pick it. Basically, that's what it came down to.
I understand that. And I was debating between this and The Big Sleep. And I think maybe The Big Sleep is a little, it's a little later, maybe has more of a noir look to it, but I also picked The Maltese Falcon for my number three, just because I think it's a little bit darker, less of a love story than The Big Sleep. And I mean, hey, it's got Bogart, Lorre, and Greenstreet, so it's Casablanca, right?
Well, I also picked The Big Sleep. However, I'm looking at my list now and I see two number threes. So I'm going to have to cut something out. I will take The Big Sleep out of my number two slot. So, but yeah, The Big Sleep is also a great movie along the same similar lines, and it is much thicker into the noir genre. But my real number two is going to be The Sweet Smell of Success from 1957. And Burt Lancaster plays such a chilling villain in this movie. He's this media tycoon, and the kind of villain that's all the more powerful for being understated. I mean, he never raises his voice. He just has this quiet menace to him. He's this tower of immobility. I mean, his strength, he's rigid, he's determined. He's always calm, but you always know there's this boiling fury on the inside. Anyway, he hires this slimy press agent to break up a love affair between his sister and another man that he doesn't think very much of. And however underhanded he has to get to do it, that's okay by him. Like all the best noir, again, we're digging into these darker sides of human nature and showing how these strange situations, in this case, one very powerful man manipulating people's personal lives, shows how these several different characters, all with their own strong passions, intersect and collide, and how this situation affects them and twists them and drives them to extreme behavior. A great, great film.
Okay, so for my number two pick, I wanted to pick another neo-noir, and I was kind of torn, but you know, I said I was trying to pick, you know, not quite total standards, but sometimes these lists are tough because I want to just go off the board entirely and pick random stuff. And I ended up just go ahead and picking a safer pick. And so my last neo-noir film is Chinatown from 1974 by Roman Polanski, which, if you're only going to see one neo-noir, this is probably the one to see. It really owes a debt to the classic noir, perhaps more than any of the other of the famous neo-noir films. It really does. And as much as it owes a debt to those, it also owes a debt to the hard-boiled crime fiction of the 1930s, particularly. It takes place in the 30s in Los Angeles, and it stars Jack Nicholson as a PI who gets caught up in this whole crazy plot involving Los Angeles water that feels like it came out of Raymond Chandler. But we get a sense that this is in the 1970s. It's grittier and dirty and more raw than a film in the 40s could have been. And it's in color, but does a wonderful job of working with its color. It kind of really did help kick off the neo-noir movement. We talked about before that they never really stopped making noir films. Well, this is the one that made it really hip and respectable to really dig into the vault and start remaking the same kind of styles that they were doing in the 40s with a little bit of a 70s twist to it. And it's just a wonderful film that holds up really well today. So there you go. Number two is Chinatown.
Absolutely. My number one is going to be Double Indemnity. I mentioned it before. I have to again. It is probably my favorite noir film. It's a close call with a few others, but I just love it. I love what it does and says about the way people are and behave. And well, anyway, the idea is Fred McMurray runs afoul of Barbara Stanwyck, and she drives him to extreme behavior. Again, touching on the heart of the genre here. You know what's funny? Roger Ebert mentioned that in his review of this, that they behave like they're impassioned and obsessed, but are they really, or are they just behaving because that's the kind of mode of behavior that they understand and think they have to fill these roles? That's kind of a strange thought about that movie, but very intriguing one. If you watch the movie with that in mind, I think you get a whole new dimension. And that's a real great thing about the movie in general, is you can just approach it from any of many different angles and get a whole new reading on the thing. I mean, the characters are just so well drawn, the relationship is so well drawn, that I think it speaks in a lot of different ways and has a lot of different things to say. Love the movie. I don't know what else to say about it.
Yeah, no surprise to anyone. This is also my number one, and you said most of the thing I was going to say about it, so yeah, we've talked about it in depth before, so there you go, number one, Double Indemnity.
All right, well, let's recap. And again, I liked your neo-noir picks. I just wasn't considering them eligible, so that's why they didn't appear on mine. I think L.A. Confidential, though, is my favorite neo-noir. Anyway, number six for me is Mildred Pierce. Number five, Laura. Number four, Notorious. Number three, The Maltese Falcon. Number two, Sweet Smell of Success. Number two again, The Big Sleep. And number one, Double Indemnity.
My top six noir films, you know, I'm not trying to pick the necessarily the best six noir, just trying to give you a bit of range here in my list. Number six was Body Heat from 81 by Lawrence Kasdan. Number five, Shadow of a Doubt, Hitchcock's 1943 pseudo-noir. Number four, Dark City, a science fiction noir from 1998 by Alex Proyas. Number three, The Maltese Falcon, a proto-noir, if you will, from 1941 by John Huston. Number two, Polanski's masterpiece Chinatown from 1974. And number one, just like Sam, Billy Wilder's Double Indemnity from 1944. So we're going to get into our third and final industry trend look at censorship in movies, and this time also really go over the current rating system, and we've, you know, been really working up to that. So just to recap, we left you last time in the early 1960s. We talked a bit about how some high-profile films like Some Like It Hot and Psycho had been released into theaters without approval of the Production Code Authority, and this trend is going to really continue in the 1960s. Not just foreign and independent films, but also major studio films are going to start getting released without Production Code approval. We're going to, of course, have to start, as we always have been, with a little bit more talk about the legal system. Again, you know, I mentioned last time that the obscenity rules are going to be really changing pretty rapidly during this point of time, and almost always they're going to be changing to be more and more allowing. So states and local governments are going to have less and less power to restrict things just on the basis of, you know, it has obscene content in it. This is the point in American history where pornography is going to become much more readily available and legal. And so obviously if pornography is going to be legal in most places, it's going to be quite difficult to ban movies that may be controversial but are not pornography. Though in 1968, the Supreme Court makes a particularly important ruling in two court cases when, even though it strikes down laws that were trying to ban specific movies or create these censorship boards, it does say that states have the right to restrict movies to children that otherwise they might not be able to restrict to adults. So, you know, you couldn't stop adults from seeing these sorts of movies, but you might well be able to restrict children from seeing them. And so that is, of course, something that the industry is going to pay attention to, and the studios do not want to see a return to a bunch of censorship boards throughout the country. You know, the kind of ones that still exist are stragglers. You know, it's a pain for them to have to deal with it, and, you know, the production code is failing, so it presents a real good opportunity to just overhaul the entire system. So in 1966, a guy named Jack Valenti becomes the head of the organization that's now called the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America. This is that same association that was started back in the 20s to be PR for the studios. And, you know, Valenti actually just very recently passed away, and he's going to pretty much be the head of this up through the 2000s, and he's going to be a very influential guy. And when he takes over in 1966, he's faced immediately with the problem of the film adaptation Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which is a very high-profile film by director Mike Nichols. It's based on this really successful play, and it's aimed at adults, and it's coming in 1966, but the big problem for the MPAA is that it contains two bits of dialogue that are really going to be problematic. It has the word screw, as in, you know, like screw you kind of screw, and also has the phrase hump the hostess, neither of which are going to be acceptable under the code. And Valenti ends up negotiating this kind of compromise where they take out the word screw, but they leave in the words hump the hostess, which is just the screwiest, weirdest kind of compromise you could really imagine. But somehow Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf gets a production code approval. And, I mean, look, if that can get it, then we can see that the production code doesn't really mean that much anymore. And Valenti wrote about this. There's a thing we'll provide a link to on the website. You can read about Jack Valenti describing the origin of the ratings board. And he talks about this exact incident. And he says, "It seemed wrong that grown men should be sitting around discussing such matters. Moreover, I was uncomfortable with the thought that this was just the beginning of an unsettling new era in film in which we would lurch from crisis to crisis without any suitable solution in sight." And he's right. I mean, it's pretty clear to people who are paying attention in the 1960s that American film is changing pretty rapidly, and that the production code with its really rigid sort of set of things you couldn't do just wasn't going to last. So they end up creating something called the Classification and Ratings Administration. It's an arm of the MPAA, and it's sort of independent of the MPAA, not quite, but the idea is that they're going to rate films. We're going to throw out the production code, and that happens in November of 1968. This thing comes online, and it's going to have four ratings: G, which, you know, we all know it still exists. M, which is called mature, which means parental guidance suggested, but all ages are admitted. The R rating, restricted, which, again, still exists today. It says, children under 16 would not be admitted without an accompanying parent or adult. This got moved up to 17 later, and at some places it may be 18, or it may vary a little bit depending on what the local laws are. And the final rating was X, no one under 17 admitted. And G, M, and R are all going to be trademarked by the MPAA, and only the ratings board can give them out. You have to submit your film for approval to the ratings board, they'll look at it, and they'll assign it a rating. And you cannot go ahead and assign it your own rating, with the exception of X. The idea behind X was, well, look, there are some movies the filmmakers don't intend them to be seen by children at all. There's really no point in us having to waste our time rating those movies, because the whole point of the ratings board is to provide guidance for parents. Parents should have an idea of whether or not this is appropriate for children, and then they can kind of hopefully just avoid the whole censorship issue, and they can avoid having to dictate what could and couldn't be in films. It's now become advisory. So the MPAA is going to buy into this system, and so is the National Association of Theater Owners, sort of this formed by a couple different organizations, and most theaters are going to adhere to this. So they're only going to show movies if they have ratings, or early on if they're rated X. X, though, is going to have kind of an interesting history to it. It's not trademarked, like I said. Anyone can apply it to themselves. And at first, it's kind of used and it works out well. The film Midnight Cowboy in 1969, you know, this is the very first year that you could have gotten an X rating, wins Best Picture. And it says, okay, it's an adult movie. It wins Best Picture that year. It'll be actually later reclassified to R when it gets re-released, which, you know, was something that some people have used to sort of attack the integrity of the ratings board, the idea that, well, you rated this movie R, suddenly now that it's won Best Picture, but not before, anyway. But pretty quickly thereafter, X is going to be used by pornographers. And the idea is, oh, our movie's not just X, it's double X, and then triple X. So now, you know, the word triple X basically is slang for porn these days. So it's going to require some changes later on. Eventually, in the early 1990s, X will be dropped by the MPAA. They won't even acknowledge it anymore. They'll say, you can do it if you want to, but they're going to create an NC-17 rating that's going to pretty much replace X, and it's going to be trademarked, though, so you have to get it from the MPAA, and basically it's going to function the same as X. You can't go into it if you're under 17, but the thing about NC-17 is when it's brought up, pretty much it's portrayed as being the replacement for X. It got to the point in the 70s and 80s where mainstream movie theaters would not show X-rated films just because of the connotation they had. And more or less, sadly, NC-17 has become exactly the same thing. Most mainstream movie theaters will not show NC-17 rated movies. And it was sort of a controversy. Every now and then, a mainstream film kind of toys with the idea of releasing with an NC-17 rating. Unfortunately, the real first test case for this was that terrible film Showgirls in the early 90s, which had an NC-17 rated version. And look, it's a crappy film anyway, and it's basically an exploitation movie. It's you know, half a step away from porn anyway. So, I mean, that was the big first NC-17 film, which means everyone decided, look, obviously NC-17 is the new X, and so there are virtually no NC-17 films. Every now and then, some get released, but you can't go see them at most movie theaters. A lot of video stores won't carry NC-17-rated movies, so really the NC-17 rating is kind of unworkable still. There are a lot of times if a film, especially independent films, they get submitted for ratings, or foreign films, they come back NC-17, the studio or the distributor will just release them unrated, so you can go see them at, you know, some, this kind of way they can sometimes sneak into the mainstream video stores that won't carry NC-17 titles. Oftentimes, these are not movies that will ever be shown at a mainstream theater anyway. Not necessarily because of their content, but because all these tiny little independent films are only going to be shown at maybe a dozen theaters anyway, so for them to be released unrated isn't that big of a deal. Now, the M rating I mentioned before, you may not have heard of, the M for mature audiences between G and R. Well, the MPAA realized real quickly that M sounded worse than R. You know, R is restricted, but M is mature, so parents got confused and thought, we can't show, we can't let our kids see M-rated movies, so it got changed really quickly to GP and then to PG, because it's easier to remember. PG is parental guidance. And in 1984, the MPAA added PG-13 in order to deal with films, particularly caused by Spielberg, of all people, really kind of prompted this with Temple of Doom, the second Indiana Jones film. That was actually rated PG, and people thought it was pretty dark. You know, you see a guy get his heart ripped out. That's rated PG. And also Gremlins, which Spielberg produced, was also rated PG and had a lot of violence. So right around that time, the MPAA came out with the PG-13 rating.
Which is, I think, the only rating used today. Is that true? There's only PG-13 movies out, right? I mean, every once in a while you hear about a PG or something, but...
Yeah, well...
I don't understand the ratings board. They have five ratings, and they use two of them.
Yeah, PG-13 and R are going to be the most common. There are a fair amount of PG films, actually. It is kind of strange. And so we should talk about that, actually. One kind of controversial issue is, why do they rate these movies the way they rate them? Who are rating movies? The members of the ratings board are more or less trying to be kept anonymous by the MPAA. The idea is that, you know, there's this sort of balance between accountability and neutrality. The MPAA insists, look, if we keep them secret, you can't influence them. But if we don't know who they are, how can we hold them accountable for their ratings? You know, there have been some allegations that studios have influence over this system, but I don't think there's any real proof that it occurs. You can think what you want. It's tough to say. But because they more or less do their business in secret, it's really tough to know what's going on. The only qualification to sit on the ratings board is that you be a parent. And that's really it. The head of the MPAA, so can't actually influence the ratings. None of the MPAA studios get to sit in on the ratings meetings, that kind of thing. And so it's this group of people. They all write down what they think the movie should be rated after they watch it, and they take a vote on it, and majority wins. So if most people have thought it should be rated R, that's what it gets. Now, each member, when they're rating a movie, actually fills out a sheet explaining why they think it should be rated the way it is. In case a studio says, well, you know, we got a rated we didn't want. Let's say you have a teenage comedy, and you want it rated PG-13, and it gets rated R. Well, the studio can ask to know why it was rated that way, and then they'll get these sheets back that explain what the different members thought that, you know, caused it to be rated R, and the studio can then make cuts to it and then resubmit it. That kind of thing happens. And there's also an appeals process. If you believe that your rating was incorrect and that you don't want to make any cuts to it, you can go ahead and appeal it. And then the people who sit on the appellate board are actually different and consists of this sort of like wide-ranging industry group. And so who sits on the appellate board is a little different than the makeup of the ratings board. It includes like representatives from various industry groups, watchdog agencies, that kind of thing. And so here, you know, there are some famous examples where ratings have been overturned. You know, I think of in 1994, Kevin Smith's film Clerks, when it was rated for a release, was rated NC-17, but the movie doesn't have any nudity, doesn't have any sex in it, there's no violence. All it has is a lot of really harsh language, you know, lots of discussions of sexual acts, but it doesn't actually show any. And so, you know, they appealed it to the appeals board and actually got it changed down to an R rating. And so that's sort of a pretty important decision. In the 1990s, and you see a lot of movies that have all sorts of discussion of things you could never show in an R-rated movie, but are allowed to have them. And you sometimes hear all sorts of strange stories about working with the MPAA ratings board. And because you never know who's going to be on the board watching it, and there are no hard and fast rules for why a movie is R rather than PG-13, it's kind of strange. There's some great stories. Trey Parker and Matt Stone, when they did the South Park film, talked about they would submit it to the ratings board, get, you know, an NC-17 rating with all these notes. They would then go back and change the scenes that were problematic, but they said, well, we actually made them worse. We made them more offensive, resubmitted it, and then we would have no feedback on that because it was different people watching the movies and they thought that it was okay. So it's kind of a weird, fluid process. And a lot of people have criticized the MPAA for not having strict guidelines, but on the other hand, in the MPAA's defense, do you want another Hays Code, a list of things you can and cannot do in a PG-13, can and cannot do in an R? So, I mean, all of this is going to be very subjective, so it's going to be difficult. But again, I mean, whether it's good or bad, obviously, is subjective. But I think definitely the studios prefer it to the older systems where you were either excluded from doing things or you had to deal with a billion different local boards.
Probably so, because senses of morality change, and you can argue that I would actually argue that in some sense that's a bad thing to always be on top of that curve, but again, it's not very effective if you go, I mean, we've seen this in history, it's not very effective if you go many decades without updating that to try to be mirroring what people generally think.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, and you can see just since the MPAA ratings have gone in that there have been changing moral standards, and it hasn't all been loosened either. If you look at a lot of 80s movies, and especially 70s movies, you can find movies rated PG that would definitely be an R today.
Yeah, absolutely.
People are more sensitive about different things at different times. You know, at one point, language is going to be no big deal, and nudity is, and then vice versa 20 years later. That can happen. So I think it's important to some extent to make sure you keep mirroring that so that you don't become obsolete and have a problematic situation.
Right. Well, the last thing I just want to talk about a little bit about is, so that it's clear, the MPAA ratings board, the CARA, is completely voluntary. No one is required to do it. It has no legal authority, and there's no legal penalty if, for instance, you show an R-rated film to a kid without checking ID or something. You know, you can get in trouble with the trade groups. The theater organizations will be upset at you. The Motion Picture Association can, you know, threaten to withhold movies or whatever from you. But this is basically allowed to be legal. You know, there's not much of a case that this is censorship, and this is a sort of an important transition. So really, the creation of the ratings board more or less put an end to censorship by governments. You know, obviously the Supreme Court decisions that made it really tough for them to create censorship boards have a big part in it, but really we've moved out of an era of film censorship to this ratings board. Now, you can argue that since no mainstream studio is going to release, you know, an NC-17 rated film or an unrated film, you could argue that it is sort of de facto censorship, but it's really not true censorship. This is not a government agency, and it is voluntary, and if they wanted to, the studios could always choose to just buck the system and do their own thing, but obviously it seems to be working out pretty well for them.
Yeah, I mean, you can cry out about market forces being a de facto censorship, but anything's better than the government dictating what you can and cannot do. And really, I mean, I guess we've made this point, but just to make it crystal clear, this is the primary purpose, as I see it, of the not only the rating system, but the Hays Code. It was for the movie industry to start regulating itself before the government stepped in and say, okay, we're going to enforce this on you. And once the government, if the government makes that step, you can't undo it, really, and you're kind of at the mercy of the government. I mean, what's more powerful than the government? And so there was this real sense that, hey, if we do this ourselves, we'll forestall a legal means of having these same things in practice. So whatever complaints you can make about the MPAA and the rating system, and I have plenty, you know, it's better than the alternative.
It's back to the ugly vampire portion of All Movie Talk, where we're talking about an actor who was so visually perfect for the role of a vampire that the director of a vampire movie with him in it figured, just add some ears and false teeth and he'll be fine. Do you have any idea who I'm talking about?
I figure it has to be either Tom Cruise or Brad Pitt.
Okay, well, that isn't the answer, but it's better than my answer, so why don't we leave it at that? No, it's Max Schreck, actually, from Nosferatu.
Yeah, that was my real guess, by the way.
Directing, and okay, I believe you, because I would think you'd know that. But yeah, Brad Pitt, Tom Cruise, I like those answers better.
So that closes things up for this week. Go ahead and check out the website, though, where things aren't closed up at allmovietalk.com. If you haven't been there in a while, we've had a lot of good posts and discussion lately, including discussions about reviews of a lot of the big summer movies this year. So if you're interested in checking out some of our thoughts on those flicks, again, check out the website at allmovietalk.com.
And also check out rinkworks.com, rinkworks.com, as I never get tired of saying. Next week, we'll be back with another episode. That'll be next Tuesday on the 17th, and we're going to talk about... Oh, well, we're going to do actually another of our most frequent segments called Famous Frame. Come back for that. We'll continue talking about the Coen brothers, and our top six list will be movies that you would like to see remade. Think about movies that... might be good. You want a remake for. Usually we don't want remakes, but check back with us next week.
Yeah? Hey. Not much. Just shooting a little podcast here. What's up with you? No, yeah. Hold on a sec. What? Are we still rolling? Ah, cut!